We all know that the Bible contains many different stories. Each week at Open the Book, for example, we tell a different one to the children at school. But we also know that as we read the Bible, those many different stories combine to make one long story. A story that runs from the Garden of Eden in Genesis to the city of God in Revelation. The story of God's love and care for the human race. The story of how he made us for great things, but how we fell away from his purposes and how he set about bringing us back. So it's a rescue story, a salvation story. And earlier this year, we looked at the pinnacle of that story as we studied Mark's gospel, how God came in Jesus, the servant king, to give his life as a ransom for many. Our great high priest offering the perfect sacrifice to reconcile us to God by washing away our sins. But as you look at the Bible, you see there's not just one, but two great salvation stories in it. Because right back at the beginning of the Bible, God also did something amazing to rescue his people. Something so important that as we looked at the Psalms recently, we saw them referring back to it and remembering it over and over again. Something so fundamental that the story of Jesus builds on it and refers to that earlier event. And what I'm talking about is the story we have in the book of Exodus. The story we'll be looking at between now and Easter. The story of how God rescued his people Israel from slavery in Egypt. How he made them into a nation. And how he made them his holy people. Gave them his law to live by. And provided them with the means for their sins to be forgiven. So that they could come close to him. Even though as fragile and sinful human beings, they would never otherwise be able to come anywhere near God. So, the book of Exodus, the second book of the Bible. As you'd appreciate, it's a long book, and the passages each week would be too long to read all of them out loud. So may I suggest you prepare for these sermons by reading the whole passage for yourself beforehand. So that way you'll get the whole story, and not just the bits that time forces me to pick out. And where does Exodus begin? Well, right at the beginning in chapter 1, it's talking about Jacob, the grandson of Abraham, and his 12 sons. So right at the start, it's putting down a marker that it's continuing the story from the book of Genesis. In fact, I'm told that in Hebrew, the whole book starts with the word and. You just don't do that in grammar. But Exodus does. And that tells us it's carrying on from what came before. And what was that story? God created the world and made human beings to be the ones responsible for running it. But we rebelled against God. And so God chose Abraham and his family to be the means he was going to use to rescue the world. And he promised Abraham a country, and that his descendants would be a great nation, and that all the world would be blessed through them. And Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac the father of Jacob. And Jacob had a huge family, 12 sons, including Joseph, he of the many-coloured coat. And at the end of Genesis, we read the story of Joseph, how he was rejected by his brothers, sold as a slave and ended up in Egypt, but how God was with him even there, how he overcame all the problems he faced and rose to a position of power and trust, second only to Pharaoh himself. And how he ended up using that power to rescue his family and bring them all safe to Egypt when famine struck their land. And so Genesis ends with Abraham's descendants, 70 people in all, settled in Egypt and at peace. And that's where Exodus takes up the story. So we'll read from Exodus chapter 1 on page 58 in the church Bibles if you have them. These are the names of the sons of Israel who went to Egypt with Jacob, each with his family: Reuben, Simeon, Levi and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. The descendants of Jacob numbered 70 in all. Joseph was already in Egypt. Now Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died. But the Israelites were fruitful and multiplied greatly and became exceedingly numerous, so that the land was filled with them. Then a new king, who did not know about Joseph, came to power in Egypt. "Look," he said to his people, "the Israelites have become much too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country." So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor. And they built Pithom and Ramesses as store cities for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with hard labor in brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their hard labor, the Egyptians used them ruthlessly. And then we'll skip over a bit about how the Israelites generally got round some of the restrictions and pick it up again at verse 22. Then Pharaoh gave this order to all his people: "Every boy that is born you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live." Now, a man of the house of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. Then Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the river bank. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her slave girl to get it. She opened it and saw the baby. He was crying and she felt sorry for him. "This is one of the Hebrew babies," she said. Then his sister asked Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you?" "Yes, go," she answered. And the girl went and got the baby's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you." So the woman took the baby and nursed him. When the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, saying, "I drew him out of the water." One day, after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were and watched them at their hard labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Glancing this way and that and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. The next day he went out and saw two Hebrews fighting. He asked the one in the wrong, "Why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew?" The man said, "Who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and thought, "What I did must have become known." When Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, where he sat down by a well. Now a priest of Midian had 7 daughters, and they came to draw water and fill the troughs to water their father's flock. Some shepherds came along and drove them away, but Moses got up and came to their rescue and watered their flock. When the girls returned to rule their father, he asked them, "Why have you returned so early today?" They answered, "An Egyptian rescued us from the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the flock." "And where is he?" he asked his daughters. "Why did you leave him? Invite him to have something to eat." Moses agreed to stay with the man, who gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses in marriage. Zipporah gave birth to a son, and Moses named him Gershom, saying, I've become an alien in a foreign land. During that long period, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. So we start Exodus with 400 years of history passed over in just a few verses. You may wonder, well, why so long? Did nothing happen in all that time? Was God doing anything? How do we deal with the times when nothing much seems to be happening? Because sometimes things are quiet. Nothing spectacular happens. Is God still with us in those times? But you see, something was going on through all that time. It seems that there was one command that the Israelites never seemed to have any problem obeying. In fact, they applied themselves to it with commendable vigour. And it was this: go forth and multiply. To become a people, the Hebrews. Because 70 descendants of Abraham went down to Egypt with Joseph. But it's reckoned that up to 600,000 left with Moses. So in that quiet time, the time when nothing much seemed to happen, a people was being built. Not yet a nation, because that part of the story is still to come. But they were growing to the point where they began to be noticed. And not noticed in a good way. Because Pharaoh was starting to lose sleep over them. Yep, some things never change, do they? There's this group of people living among us who are different from us. Perhaps they'll turn against us. I know. Why don't we persecute them? That's the way to stop them becoming our enemies, isn't it? Yes, some things never change. And so life for the Israelites, the Hebrews, is made hard. They're reduced to slavery. And eventually, even worse, the order is put out that every male child is to be killed. So the Israelites, even in the uninteresting path of history, are fulfilling both God's creation command to go forth and multiply, and also his command to Abraham to become a great nation. And so Pharaoh is setting himself directly against those goals. And in doing so, he's setting himself directly against God's plans. But the people of Israel find themselves in the wrong place. In the wrong country, because Egypt isn't the promised land God promised to Abraham. And in the wrong situation, because being worked as slaves means they cannot be the people God wants to use to rescue and bless the world. The situation is all wrong and something has to change. You might be tempted to ask, well, where is God in all this? Doesn't he care that his people are in such a mess? Just how bad do things have to get? And that's why our reading finishes with this verse. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. God remembered. Not that he'd forgotten them, but emphasizing that this is all about a plan that he had from the beginning. That this was how he was going to rescue the world. A long time passed because they needed to grow into a nation. But the time now was right. And God was going to intervene directly in their situation. And the man he was going to use was Moses. In fact, those verses about the people groaning and God remembering come after a whole chapter describing the first 80 years of Moses' life. This plan, this rescue had already started long before. God hadn't forgotten, but he does often work through people. and people take time to grow. And so we're introduced to this man Moses, the leading character of the book of Exodus, and in particular how he escaped Pharaoh's order to kill all the male children. Obviously, he wasn't the only one to escape, because when the Exodus came, there were plenty of men around. But it does give us a reason why Moses had this surprising access to a later Pharaoh. The ability to confront him that an ordinary slave just wouldn't have. It was because in one sense he was family, the adopted son of a royal princess. And so we're told the story of how his mother hides him from those who would kill him. How she trusts God by floating him on the Nile in a basket. And just as an aside, I'm told that the word used for a basket here is the same as that used for Noah's Ark. A quite deliberate reference back to Genesis again. God rescued his people in Noah's time with an ark, and here he is doing it again, on a different scale, with the basket, the ark, that carries the baby Moses. And then come a number of quite funny turns in the story, where the author seems to take a delight in telling us how God thumbs his nose at the plan of those who oppose him. Because where does the basket wash up? Why, at the right in front of an Egyptian princess, Pharaoh's daughter, no less. And what's her reaction? Oh, isn't he cute? He must be one of the Hebrew babies. Can I keep him? Wait a minute. I'm the princess, of course I can keep him. For one thing, that shows us that not every Egyptian was happy with Pharaoh's order, even in his own family. And then, of course, because princesses don't do nappies, who's going to look after that side of things? Cue Moses' sister, who just happens to be on hand. I can go and fetch one of the Hebrew women. I'm sure she'll look after him for you. Mum! And so Moses not only escapes death, but he ends up in the royal palace, brought up effectively as the grandson of the man who'd ordered him killed, and with his own Hebrew mother as his nurse. So here he is, growing up with a full royal Egyptian education, someone with access to the royal family, to the core of power in the kingdom, but also growing up knowing the traditions of his own people, the Hebrews, of the stories of the God of Israel and his promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And as he grows to a young man, he's torn between these two worlds. Conscious of his own privileged life, yes, also the fate of his true people. And the question is, which way is he going to go? And so we come to the crisis moment. He sees an Egyptian mistreating a Hebrew slave. And with a young man's sense of justice and anger, and also with a young man's impetuosity and lack of thought, he ends up killing the Egyptian. Now perhaps members of the royal family might have thought they could get away with things like that. But it's quite obvious that this was going to come back to bite him in a bad way. Because the very next day, when he tries to stop a fight between two Hebrews, they make it plain that everyone knows about it. And if they know, then Pharaoh will find out soon enough. And so Moses is forced to flee, to run away to the land of Midian, on the far side of Sinai, a place beyond Pharaoh's reach. But a place where once again he seems to fall on his feet, being taken in by Reuel, the priest of Midian, who also goes by the name of Jethro in the story, marrying one of his daughters and settling down to the life of a shepherd. So, was it all a failure? Had Moses really messed up God's plan? Well, the Bible doesn't actually pass any judgment on it. The book of Hebrews hints that Moses was acting in faith when he left Egypt. And God's call to Moses, which we'll look at next week, waited for possibly decades. God does things in his own time. But he doesn't forget. He does remember his covenant promises. And he will work it out just as he's planned. And so we come to the end of this week's visit to Exodus. Next week, the pace of the story picks up with Moses and the burning bush. But what can we take away from the story today? And I think it's first of all about trust. Trust in God's faithfulness and care, whatever the circumstances. Think of those 400 years covered by the first few verses. The Israelites weren't yet slaves, but they were also weren't in the promised land. And nothing much seemed to be happening. Was God with them? Was he doing anything? Is it all just too quiet? Can't we live in a more exciting time? One thing that studying history teaches you is never to look down on the quiet times when you're going through them. Because what's the alternative? There's an ancient curse. May you live in interesting times. And it's a curse because interesting times are times of war and plague and panic and old ways being turned upside down. And when we live in those times, what we long for above everything else is to go back to the quiet times. But of course, God was doing something among them. He was working out his promise to make them a great nation. He was growing their numbers from 70 to 600,000. He was making them into a nation. And what seemed like the ordinary, dull flow of life was all part of his plan, which would eventually lead to Jesus and the salvation of the world. And then, of course, at the end of those years, the interesting times did come. The hard times of persecution and slavery, and the people's groans went up to God. Why is this happening to us? Why aren't you doing anything about it? But of course, he was doing something about it. He did remember his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He'd already started Moses on the course that would eventually set the people free. But Moses had to grow up first. And sometimes we just have to be patient and wait. You know, some people will tell you that if you just have enough faith, everything will work out well for you. Things will be sorted out and you'll have all the riches you want. And that's rubbish. In fact, God promises more that we have to face hard times. But what are we going to do when they come? The first answer is to trust. Today's passage tells us that God does have a plan and that he is working things out. Not necessarily to the time scale we'd like, but in his own time, for when his time is right. So we keep faith, we trust, and we're patient. And to help us in that? Well, I find that other people's stories help. If they can tell us about their own lives, looking back from afterwards to say how God did bring them through, and that can be an encouragement to us in what we're going through. So testimonies are good, particularly testimonies of hard times gone through and problems overcome. So let's have more of them. And of course, there are our own testimonies. Do we, in fact, have something to share? Do we have a story to tell about hard times that we faced? Particularly from afterwards, when we've come through on the other side. Then could those stories be useful to somebody else? Let's learn to tell each other our stories so that they and we can be encouraged together. You know, I've said Moses is the main character of the book of Exodus, but of course, in reality, he isn't. It's God. Because it's God who's the one who ties this story into the bigger one. Of promises made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and now being brought to their conclusion by the faithfulness of God to his covenant. We trust in the God who is faithful, who remembers his promises, and who is working through them to save the world. Amen.